arms trade, so much so that even he has complained about being used to market weapons in his perhaps more sober moments. But this is still a man who, this is his job, and you can see here where there is, it's a job that's been done as a role that the royal family always carry out, regardless of whether they have a sort of momentary crisis of conscience or whatever. But it remains the case that up until very recent years and months, the royal family, and Prince Charles in particular, have been responsible for closing very big arms deals, particularly with Saudi Arabia. This is another monarchy which can probably does actually beat the royal family in terms of its just reactionary nature. This is a regime that regularly decapitates people for adultery and witchcraft and drug use and anything you can name, really. So this is a thoroughly reactionary state, and one that has committed crimes against humanity, that the British monarchy have rubber stamped these kinds of sales.
The palace denied that the princes, Saudi and British, discussed the arms deal.
One of the key questions is, why do the Saudi Arabian government, or the Bahraini regime, or any others, want to have Prince Charles or Prince Andrew go over to their country and shake hands and greet and be taken around tourist sites? And the reason is because it gives them legitimacy. It gives a British endorsement. What it says is that not just is the United Kingdom prepared to do business with you, we are prepared to send over one of the heads of state to go over and do our bidding. And what it says is that Prince Charles is being used by BAE Systems and is being used as an arms dealer.
A previous investigation into UK-Saudi arms deals, Margaret Thatcher's sale of Tornado aircraft in the Al Yamama deal, was blocked by Tony Blair on national security grounds.
Prince Andrew's done more than his fair share of whining and dining with some of the most repressive regimes and dictators in the world. Earlier this year, Prince Andrew was in Bahrain as part of Great British Week, where he went over with some of the great British companies like BAE Systems and other arms companies, Rolls-Royce, who were there specifically to sell weapons and to make deals with some of the most repressive governments in the world.
There is a direct relationship between what the royal family are doing in relation to arms sales and in relation to imperial wars, let it be said, because, of course, members of the royal family serve in the armed forces, and by serving in the armed forces, Harry in Afghanistan, for example, what they do is they put a kind of gloss on those kinds of imperial interventions. So the royal family is involved in the imperialist wars in that sense, is giving its blessing to those imperialist wars, and selling arms to Saudi Arabia is selling arms to an extremely reactionary monarchy with an appalling human rights record. An appalling record on civil liberties, which is also using its military power, projecting its military power elsewhere to suppress revolutionary movements in Bahrain 2 or 3 years ago and currently in Yemen.
Former South African MP Andrew Feinstein resigned in protest over BAE bribery allegations. He has his own experience of the royal family's arms interests.
We tried to investigate a huge and very corrupt arms deal. BAE won the contract in very controversial circumstances. The plane that the Air Force wanted was 2.5 times less expensive than the BAE offering and was far more suited to South Africa's needs. But the Metropolitan Police have estimated that £115 million in bribes were paid on that one deal alone. And unfortunately, the British royal family were intimately involved, together with Tony Blair, the then Prime Minister, in persuading the new South African government to buy these trainers and jet fighters, to the extent that the then Royal Yacht Britannia was sailed to Cape Town Harbour with some members of the royal family aboard, and they invited to dinner those ministers who were going to make the crucial decision about the BAE system.
Strangely, perhaps, a Buckingham Palace spokesman who spoke to The Guardian had much the same view, with an added tinge of colonial snobbery. Middle East potentates like meeting princes. He comes in as the son of the queen, and that opens doors that otherwise would remain closed. He can raise problems with the crown prince, and 4 or 5 weeks later, we discover that the difficulties have been overcome and the contract can be signed. He brings an immeasurable value in smoothing the path for British companies. We don't send him to developed countries like France and Sweden, where a member of the royal family would not make a difference. But in developing countries or the Far East, a prince can get in because of who he is.
One of the characteristics of British capitalism, the British economy, in recent times, really, I suppose, since the Second World War, has been that the arms industry has played a very important role in the British economy and in British trade. The British are very keen to sell top-of-the-range weapons technology. Very often, the market is dictators, particularly dictators in the Middle East and North Africa. And if you want to establish diplomatic relations and trading relations with feudal or semi-feudal regimes in the Middle East and North Africa, it helps if you've got your own royals who can operate at that social level, who can give you an entree. So Prince Charles has played a major role, Prince Andrew has played a major role, other royals, I'm sure, as well, have played a role in developing these diplomatic relations and helping arms manufacturers to sell weapons to Middle Eastern dictators.
Unlike the case of Prince Andrew, when there have been other members of royal families in other parts of the world who have got involved, for instance, in the arms trade and behaved inappropriately, they suffer consequences. For instance, Prince Bernhard of the Netherlands at one point was promoting arms sales into the Netherlands and was working with 2 American companies to do so. Neither of the companies realized he was working for the other, and his wife, the Queen of the Netherlands, didn't know he was working for either of them. When it was discovered that he was engaged in this activity, he was stripped of all sorts of rights and privileges, and he was never allowed to wear the uniform of the Dutch military ever again. Now, having a royal family is not ideal, but if one has one for whatever historical reasons, at least make them accountable and answerable for their actions, whereas in this country they can effectively do as they like.
But Andrew's particular form of charm worked as well on dictators whether or not they were of the royal variety. He is reported to have had a close friendship with Saif Gaddafi, son of Colonel Gaddafi, and hosted a lunch at Buckingham Palace for the son-in-law of Tunisian dictator Ben Ali, despite being warned of his corrupt activities by the British Embassy in Tunis. As for the Saudi government, the biggest market for UK arms companies, they are now using those arms in an unprovoked attack on neighbouring Yemen. In the world of international diplomacy, it is usual to distinguish between a nation's hard power and its soft power. The hard power of the US, for instance, is its military capacity and its economic strength. Its soft power might be the cultural influence of Hollywood, the social influence of its press, or the good feeling felt by millions of children around the globe towards Ronald McDonald or Captain America.
The soft power of the UK is considered to be a persuasive approach using cultural and economic means, whereas the UK hard power would be considered to be military might, aggression, war or policing.
So it is with the British monarchy. Part of its power, as we have seen, is its hard power, the power of wealth, of landed property, of direct political influence. But perhaps it has even greater influence in its exercise of soft power, the ideological and cultural influence that the royal family exerts in British society.
Well, I think in terms of the soft and hard power, so to speak, of the royal family, there are there's a clear backstop to everything that happens in British democratic life. They do sanction any political party that comes into power. In fact, in the 1970s, they overturned the election of a progressive prime minister in Australia, because it was went so far against the interests of the royal family. So they actually do have the power to overturn governments. These things are very rarely used, partly because to do that does actually draw into public awareness the actual power the monarchy has. Like the Black Spider memos, we're told that actually no, they're just a kind of, you know, they're just the icing on the cake. They're just a kind of tourist attraction. They're just, you know, symbolic figureheads and so on. But actually, with the Black Spider memos, you find out no, they're actually interfering in daily life on a regular basis. Around the Scottish independence campaign, you see that they're actually interfering in the democratic process that's going on inside Britain. So there's always the kind of a dance between their soft and their hard power. So when they use it, when they bring out the big guns, they actually expose themselves. So they're very careful. The British ruling class is very careful about how they, where they step in and where they don't step in.
It's very difficult to actually tell what power and influence the monarchy has over this government, because it's so secret. It's like the rest of the corporate lobbying industry in this country is all done behind closed doors, or as David Cameron likes to say, it's a quiet word. You know, we don't know who's speaking to whom, we don't know who's having a quiet word with whom about which policies. So I see it as actually the tip of a very large iceberg. We have a £2 billion industry that we know nothing about, and the royalty are part of that. I mean, they're exceptional because they have this kind of magic sheen around them, which is the pomp and the costumes and the dressing up that they do. And so we don't sort of question their influence as much as we should. But we should look at really who out of everybody. I mean, we should look at the whole industry. And they are lobbyists. They have private commercial interests.
The royal family is quite deliberately used by the British establishment as a traditional symbol of the hierarchical and elitist society as a whole.
The media collaborates in the cover-up. It collaborates in massaging the news in order to downplay anything which is critical of the royal family. And what it also does is it pumps up all of the kind of bread and circuses nonsense, the Hello magazine-type celebrity culture which surrounds them. So there's a royal wedding, or there's a royal baby, or whatever, and they turn it into a jamboree, which is like something out of ancient Rome or something out of medieval England. A completely kind of feudal sort of obsession with these extraordinarily rich.
After all, if people in Britain can be got to accept one incredibly wealthy individual whose position as nominal head of state and church and chief of the armed forces is hereditary, then why should they not accept an entire ruling elite based on similarly undemocratic principles? The existence of the monarchy is based on the idea of perpetual inequality as a natural order. It bolsters the old adages that seek to ensure that the status quo remains undisturbed. This is the world where the poor are always with us, where there will always be the rich man in his castle and the poor man at his gate.
If the purpose of the monarchy is as a tourist attraction, we should do two things. We should add a small levy onto the taxes and fees the tourists pay to come into the UK anyway. And that's how we could fund the British monarchy, rather than it being funded through hard-earned taxpayers' pounds and pence. That's the first thing. The second thing is, if what they're meant to be is a tourist attraction, then they should stay well out of any public debates, that constitutionally they shouldn't be involved in anyway. So Prince Andrew should not be rushing around the world like a buffoon, selling British weapons to highly inappropriate governments. Prince Charles should not be writing letters to people in decision-making positions to try and ensure that his vision of what the United Kingdom should look like architecturally is imposed on the country. Then they can be just a tourist attraction. Then I would have less of a problem with them. But as long as we are paying for their extremely luxurious lifestyle, I think we also have a right to determine what they do and don't do.
This is a world where the poor and disadvantaged are supposed to find solace in gazing on the finery of the royals, where everything from the crown jewels to Kate Middleton's wedding dress is supposed to bring glamour to lives where even small luxuries cost a week's wages. The majority of the press encourage us to forget our own troubles and worry about the happiness or otherwise of the characters in the royal soap opera. William and Kate's happy marriage, Diana and Charles's unhappy marriage, are talked about as if they matter more than the trials and joys of our own friends and relatives.
They have a very sophisticated PR machine. They are a brand that needs to be looked after, and they engage in any other practices that any other entity brand engages in. So any bad stories they will seek to quash and keep out of the media, and they will pump it full of good stories.
The unacceptable racist ramblings of the Duke of Edinburgh are suppressed. The unfortunate nonsense let slip by Prince Andrew is excused. The less appealing members of the family, like Fergie, are hidden from view or expelled from the clan.
And it is worth remembering that this is not a family who've exactly covered themselves in glory by the way they've behaved. I mean, Prince Andrew's father, the Duke of Edinburgh, has on numerous occasions been overheard making quite racist comments, highly inappropriate comments. I mean, one of the younger members of the royal family, Prince Harry, found it amusing to dress up in a Nazi uniform for a fancy dress party.
Every charitable gesture or good work, on the other hand, is magnified. It is the work of PR experts, spin doctors, and the loyal royal correspondents. But it is a national myth, and only partly believed.
The royal family is of course packaged as a family of people who are doing all sorts of good works, who are raising money for charity and that kind of thing. And of course, that's all part of the packaging. It's a necessary part of the packaging. The reality is quite different. The reality is that they are a central institution in a very conservative and traditional political order. But they are also, despite the fact they are in a sense a leftover from feudalism, they're also doing the business of modern British capitalism.
The UK would be far better off without a monarchy, just in terms of monetary value. The £45 billion that they're worth could be redistributed to a whole host of good causes, social workers, firefighters, the homeless, etc., etc. In this time of austerity, supposedly there's a 600% rise in food banks. Why doesn't the Queen or the monarchy just distribute one of their palaces, one of their castles to that? There's people going hungry in this country, and I don't see the Queen participating in the austerity movement. And we'd have a more democratic country. We as people would no longer be subjects, we'd be citizens. And finally, just to add one more thing, it's still technically illegal to discuss republicanism as an alternative to monarchy. That's something that needs to be repealed in Parliament immediately if we're to be taken seriously as a democratic country.
Despite the years of pro-royal propaganda, some 30% think the UK would be better off without a monarch. That figure rises to 50% in Scotland. Some 60% are against Prince Charles becoming king when the current Queen dies.
The easiest question to answer is, would the UK be better off without the royal family? Yes, it would. And of course, it wouldn't be the UK. It wouldn't be a united kingdom. It would be a democratic country. In fact, it would be much smaller in an ideal world. It wouldn't encroach into any of the landmass of Ireland. It wouldn't encroach even into Scotland. That's clearly said. Over 50% now actually want to separate. Most people, over 60%, admit it's inevitable that there will be a separation. This can only be a good thing, because this sort of bundle of different small countries in a small part of the European landmass, or just off the European landmass, have had exponential, disproportionate and destructive range over the entire planet for centuries, and I think for that to come to an end can only be a good thing, really.
There is no question at all that Britain would be a much healthier place without the monarchy. But the monarchy is only one of a number of antiquated institutions which are barriers to real democracy. The House of Lords is another. Our dysfunctional electoral system, our first-past-the-post system, is a third. And there are many others that one could think of. The British political system needs a radical overhaul, even to create a modern parliamentary democracy. And we need to see very, very radical changes indeed in the way in which we make decisions if the interests of ordinary people are going to be reflected going forwards.
There is likely to be a crisis of confidence, if not a constitutional crisis, when the Queen is succeeded by Charles. It will be a moment when ordinary citizens in the UK have to examine whether an hereditary, hugely wealthy, unconstitutionally influential, politically reactionary institution is still the best adornment for a supposedly democratic society in the 21st century.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. The claim that US drones are humane and effective has always been a lie. But by classifying the program as top secret and by aggressively prosecuting whistleblowers, the United States has been able to hide the truth about drones from most Americans. We'll prepare for you an article written by Leonard C. Goodman, a Chicago criminal defense lawyer and co-owner of the newly independent Chicago-based weekly Reader. The piece is titled U.S. Killer Drone Program Stays Afloat on Sea of Lies. The article has been published by the Asia Times. On 29th of August, in the final days of its 20-year occupation of Afghanistan, the United States launched a drone strike, firing a 20-pound Hellfire missile at an aid worker named Zamari Ahmadi as he parked his car outside of his home in a residential neighborhood of Kabul, Afghanistan's capital. The strike killed Mr. Ahmadi and 9 members of his family, including 7 children, 5 of whom were younger than 10 years old. The children had come outside to meet Mr. Ahmadi as he returned home from his job at a non-governmental organization where he distributed food to Afghans displaced by the war and occupation. When a surviving member of Mr. Ahmadi's family complained publicly about the errant airstrike, the U.S. Defense Department, the Pentagon, did what it has been doing for the past 20 years in Afghanistan. It simply lied. According to the New York Times, the Pentagon claimed that Mr. Ahmadi was a facilitator for Daesh terrorist group and that his car was packed with explosives, posing an imminent threat to U.S. occupation forces guarding the evacuation at Kabul airport. General Kenneth McKenzie, commander of the U.S. Central Command, claimed the drone strike dealt Daesh terrorists a crushing blow. General Mark Milley, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, called it a righteous strike. When it was confirmed that Afghan children as young as 2 years old had died in the strike, the Pentagon claimed that any civilian deaths resulted from the detonation of explosives inside the vehicle that was targeted. The U.S. military produced a wrong assessment that the occupants of the vehicle were wearing suicide vests and that the car itself was packed with explosives. Most U.S. drone strikes take place in remote areas, and no follow-up investigation is ever conducted. However, the slaughter of Mr. Ahmadi's family took place 3 kilometers from Kabul airport, at which American reporters were stationed covering the chaotic evacuation of U.S. occupation forces and allies from Kabul airport. In the days following the deadly drone strike, reporters from the New York Times conducted a thorough investigation, visiting Mr. Ahmadi's home and place of work, viewing video footage from his security cameras, and consulting with weapons experts. This investigation quickly confirmed that every official statement from the Pentagon was false. Mr. Ahmadi did not visit a Daesh safe house on the day of his death. He visited his office. His car was not loaded with explosives. It was loaded with water canisters that he was bringing home to his family because there was a water shortage in his neighborhood. After the publication of the New York Times investigation, the U.S. Defense Department, the Pentagon, conceded that it had made a tragic but honest mistake when it assassinated Mr. Ahmadi and members of his family in a drone strike. No one has been held accountable for a deadly mistake. Targeted drone killing is an innovation of the so-called war on terror. It facilitates continuous war by making it appear less costly and more humane. Indeed, President Biden has already announced that the United States will continue launching drone strikes from afar after its withdrawal from Afghanistan. Similar language was used when President Biden announced an end to American support for offensive operations in the war in Yemen, while reserving the right to continue killing Yemenis if it believes they are linked to Daesh or Al-Qaeda terrorists. And of course, don't expect any peace dividends from the end of the war in Afghanistan. In September, the U.S. House of Representatives approved, in bipartisan fashion, $778 billion in military spending for 2022, a $37 billion increase over the 2021 military budget. More than half of the funds American taxpayers have sent to the Pentagon since 11th of September 2001, about $8 trillion, has ended up in the pockets of private corporations, such as Lockheed Martin, Boeing, General Dynamics, Raytheon, and Northrop Grumman. These companies then use some of those taxpayer dollars to lobby Congress and the President to keep the wars going and the money flowing into their pockets. The late US President Dwight Eisenhower warned of the danger that a profit-seeking military-industrial complex would produce a state where wars are not fought with an intention of winning them, but to ensure that they never end. British author George Orwell articulated these dangers in his classic novel, 1984, wherein he described continuous war as an opaque, low-intensity conflict whose primary purpose was to siphon off resources and perpetuate itself. Begun under George W. Bush, the drone program was fully embraced and escalated under the presidencies of Barack Obama and Donald Trump. Barack Obama assured Americans that U.S. drones are so exceptionally surgical and precise, narrowly targeted against those who want to kill us, while not putting innocent men, women, and children in danger. The claim that drones are humane and effective has always been a lie. But by classifying the program as top secret and by aggressively prosecuting whistleblowers, the United States has been able to hide the truth from the American public. Ironically, of course, the people targeted by US drone strikes know the truth about who is being killed. Thus, the classification of all information about drones does nothing to protect national security. Rather, it protects government officials from any accountability. I have asked several members of the US Senate about the drone program and have never received a straight answer from them. In the autumn of 2009, I attended a fundraiser for Senator Chuck Schumer at a Chicago law firm. The United States has just suffered one of its deadliest months in Afghanistan, in which more than 50 Americans were killed. Senator Chuck Schumer assured the group that Barack Obama was turning things around with his unmanned killer drone program. I asked Senator Schumer about civilian deaths and whether the Central Intelligence Agency, the CIA, which then ran the drone program, had ever studied whether drones killed more terrorists than they created. The senator claimed he was pretty sure that the CIA did reach such a conclusion. In fact, as WikiLeaks later revealed, the CIA had conducted such a study in July of 2009. But that study, called CIA Best Practices in Counterinsurgency, reached the opposite conclusion, that the clandestine drone and assassination program was likely to produce counterproductive outcomes, including strengthening the very extremist groups that it was allegedly designed to destroy, particularly if non-combatants are killed in the attacks. This report was classified as secret, meaning it could be read by Senator Chuck Schumer, but not by you or me, until 2014, when WikiLeaks released it to the public. Others have come forward to expose the official lies told about the drone program. In 2014, a former signals intelligence analyst in the U.S. Air Force named Daniel Hale leaked internal documents exposing how, in 1 5-month period in Afghanistan, 90% of the people killed by U.S. drone strikes were not the intended targets. Daniel Hale also disclosed how children in areas targeted by U.S. drones cannot go out and play on clear days because that is when the drones fly. Daniel Hale said that drone operators reported having to kill a part of their conscience to keep doing their job. Hale was prosecuted under the Espionage Act for leaking these documents and has been sentenced to 45 months in prison. The investigation by the New York Times into the drone assassination of Mr. Ahmadi and his family is an important step in bringing some sunlight into the clandestine world of drone warfare. Sadly, Most victims of US drone strikes remain anonymous, as the strikes take place in remote areas of faraway countries such as Yemen, Somalia, Afghanistan, Iraq, and Libya. Much of the work to reveal the truth about drones still falls on independent investigative journalists and whistleblowers like Daniel Hale. They are our best hope to begin holding those responsible accountable and bringing an end to this dangerous lie.
Almighty God also says that, oh, the followers of the Bible, come to us and let us talk about the issues that are common amongst us. And we are agree on these points. So Sayyid Mujtaba Musavilari starts from this point.
This kind of decision that he makes puts him in a way that he start writing some papers in a collection, and we may consider that book or the publication of that book as a kind of hope-giving.
Be more familiar with outstanding Shia figures in The Teacher.
What will we say in front of it? Mu'allim.
Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is The Teacher, a program about the lives and works of the most outstanding and prominent Muslim thinkers, philosophers, jurists, and scholars, especially the Shiite one all across the world of Islam. With me in the studio are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Sheikh Mahdavi and Sheikh Zainiyah. Sheikh Mahdavi, assalamu alaikum, welcome to the show.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
And Sheikh Zainiyah, assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
We're welcome again to the program, The Teacher. Today we want to talk about an outstanding Muslim Shiite figure who dedicated his life in preaching Islam. Especially, he was concerned with the religion of Islam as a framework which can be used for the daily life, not only for the Muslims, but the human being in general, per se, all across the world. That's why the English translation of his works, you know, and also the other languages was very much welcomed by all the people all across the world, the both Muslims and the non-Muslims. He is no one but Sayyid Mujtaba Musavi Lari. Sheikh Zainiyah, let's start with you, brother. Give us a background or biographical information of Sayyid Mujtaba Musavi Lari.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Late Sayyid Mujtaba Musavi Lari was born in 1314 solar calendar or 1925 in the city of Lahr. And the city of Lahr is a small city in the southern part of Iran. And Sayyid Mujtaba Musavi Lari, rahmatullah alayhi, completed his primary education and his preliminary Islamic studies in Lahr. And then he departed for Qom from Lahr and continued his studies in Islamic studies in Qom. Besides that, he tried to write some articles regarding Islamic issues that was needed at that time in the society of Iran, especially for young people. And because he had some illness, he left for some years to Tehran. And after that, he had a trip for medical treatment to Germany. And, he had stayed for some months in Germany. And this trip had, a very deep impression in his future. And he had a meeting also with the late Sayyid Imam Musa Sadr in Germany.
Yes.
And when he came back to Iran, he decides to write a book regarding the issue of Western culture and Western society, that this book is very famous in the world nowadays.
Western Civilization Through Muslim Eyes.
Yes.
This is the English translation.
And the book is Western Civilization Through Muslim Eyes.
That's right.
Of course, this book is not only limited in English, but also it is translated into German language, Italian, French, Japanese, many other different
languages. They say 28 languages this book has been translated to. But I said your travel to Germany was a turning point. How? I mean, because he faced some of the new problems in the Western world and then decided to compile such a book?
Yes. As he himself also represents, he saw that Western society is facing with many different problems. And he felt that this culture is surrounding human being and putting him in siege. So he says that, okay, if human being wants to solve his problems and to find salvation at the end of his life or during his life even, the culture or the Western culture is not a good prescription for him. So that's why he says that Islam has teachings, that these teachings, if are implemented by human being, then human being will find salvation in his life.
That's all right. Very good. Okay. Thank you very much, Sheikh Ziani. Sheikh Mahtavi, let's get to you, brother. What other information can you give us about the scholarly life of Sayyid Mustafa Mousavi Lahori? Of course, we'll get to his main methodology of tabligh, because we know that these great muballiqeen and the preachers of Islam and all across the world have their own methods, okay? And the method of, I think, Sayyid Mustafa Mousavi Lahori is really fascinating and interesting. Before that, give us some more details about his scholarly life.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. One of the aspects of his life that I think we have to consider is this aspect, the political aspect of his life, besides his scholarly life, that inshallah we are going to talk about it. It is really interesting that we see somebody like Sayyid Mujtaba Mousavi Lahori, although he is coming from a small city in the southern part of Iran, he was really active in terms of politics. And there are memories in terms of his activities in the politics. For example, when they find out that the parliament representative of their city is not abiding by the Islamic law, they go to different ulama in order to ban him or in order to prevent him from being chosen as a parliament representative for the next time. So it shows that he was really active in terms of politics to reach this level to ban somebody from getting this position the politics. Another very important thing that must be mentioned is his social activities in terms of the cultural issues for the youth. He had this concern for the youth, no matter if they are living next to him in his city or they are living thousand miles
away.
Yes, that's away from him. So we see at his time when he was really young, when he felt that young are getting affected through the immoral content of the magazine of Zaneruz, being published by the government of Shah
at that time. That's right.
They decided to ban this magazine from being distributed in their city. So it's really important. And he has a meeting with Imam Khomeini before the revolution. And in that meeting, Imam Khomeini was talking to him with respect to the very high-level political issues that Ayatollah Burujerdi had with Imam Khomeini. And he was the representative of Imam Khomeini before the revolution. So these things show us that he was actually multi-dimensional.
Yes.
Student of Jose. He was not a kind of ordinary student of Jose. In terms of his works, he has really great works being translated in different languages.
That's right.
But this aspect of his life also should not be ignored.
I think what is important about the life of Sayyid Mujtaba Mousavi Lahori is that as an alim, as a scholar, he was concerned with the socio-cultural and religio-political affairs of his society on that time, especially among the young generation, something which is unfortunately very much neglected by some of the scholars, because, you know, a scholar might think that my scholar life and my expertise are related to my a specific major and field of study and has nothing to do with the society. But people like him, you know, especially with compiling the articles in the magazine Maktab-e Islam. He wrote so many articles over there, guiding the people on different topics, especially akhlaq. This is really important to be considered about the life and the works of Sayyid Mujtaba Musavi al-Lahri. Okay, Sheikh Ziaunia, I think this made the ground and paved the ground for him in order to preach Islam in a different way, isn't it?
Yes, you know, maybe sometimes when we want to talk about preaching Islam, we may think that, okay, if we see a non-Muslim, we should, bring some crucial issues and put them on the table and discuss about such issues. For example, we should talk about the issues that we are not agree with, non-Muslims. But Sayyid Mujtaba Musavi al-Lahri rahmatullah alayhi was thinking differently. He was saying that, okay, if we want to talk about Islamic teachings with a non-Muslim or with a Sunni brother when he was not accepting some of your ideas, then it is not necessary to start from the differences. Mm-hmm. But it's better to start from common points.
Uh-huh. Focusing on commonalities rather than differences.
Yes. Very good. This is exactly in accordance with the order of Almighty God in chapter Ali Imran, that Almighty Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم قل يا أهل الكتاب تعالوا إلى كلمة سواء بيننا وبينكم ألا نعبد إلا الله ولا نشرك به شيئا ولا يتخذ بعضنا بعضا أربابا من دون الله. Almighty God also says that all the followers of the Bible, come to us and let us talk about the issues that are common amongst us, and we are agree on these points. So Sayyid Mujtaba Musavi al-Lahri starts from this point, and from this point of view, he introduced Islam its concepts to non-Muslims, okay, and also to Sunni
showing
brothers.
The beauties of Islam to the world, I think.
Yes.
That's why most of the people, including the outstanding bilateralist and man of literature, Hamid Elgar, who has translated most of the works of Sayyid Mujtaba Musavi al-Lahri into English, were fascinated by his methods, were attracted to the religion of Islam, and finally converted to the religion of Islam. This is because of the look that Sayyid Mujtaba Musavi al-Lahri had at the religion of Islam, as you said. Also, I think he avoided sectarian the differences.
Yes.
Yes. I mean, without looking at it as a Sunni or Shia one, okay?
Yeah.
Okay.
He, as I mentioned, he is trying to highlight the, common points.
Common points, that's right.
And, he says that, okay, if we have some differences, but we have many, similarities.
Mm-hmm.
So why we should leave the similarities and just focus on the differences?
That's right.
So, for example, you mentioned the name of Hamid Elgar, the translator of most of the works of Sayyid Mujtaba Musavi al-Lahri. For example, Hamid Elgar wrote to him in a letter that after his conversion into Islam, because Hamid Elgar was a professor in the United States, and he was a well-known figure and, a scholar.
Yes.
So he says that not a week passes that in United States we have some letters from different, elites and Nobel people that they have studied your book.
Okay.
I mean the book Western
Civilization Through Muslim Eyes.
Through a Muslim Eyes.
Yes.
And they have changed their mind regarding Islam, and even some of them have converted into Islam. So it shows that the point of view by Sayyid Mujtaba Musavi al-Lahri is a correct one and is accepted by logic people and normal people.
I'm really interested if we can dedicate one separate session to Western civilization through Muslim eyes. And most of the young converts who come to the Islamic houses of Iran, one of the books for sure that they mention is this one. Okay, no more details about the scholarly method, Sheikh Mahtavi?
I think this is also good to know that he was really suffering from the digestive disease.
Mm-hmm.
When he was really young, as my brother mentioned, he was suffering from this disease, and when doctors couldn't cure him in Iran, he decided to move to Germany.
Yes.
And within his stay in Germany, this is a good excuse for everyone to give up. saying, okay, I have started this path for my life, but just in this path is something that I'm going to dedicate my life for the sake of Allah.
That's right.
But see how Allah is going to treat me. So this is a good point to give up.
Yes.
But what will happen for him? Since he realized that, okay, I have to cope with this no matter if I'm going to suffer till the end of my life. This kind of sacrifice or this kind of decision that he makes puts him in a way that it is mentioned in his memories that when he was in Germany, he started writing some papers because it was his first encounter with the Western environment and Western world.
The world, that's right.
So these papers, after all, were put in a collection and then he just put it in the format of the book.
That's right.
And we may consider that book or the publication of that book as a kind of hope-giving or a strengthening his hope.
That's right.
To keep going on this path. So it happens a lot when people come to Seminary Hosa, specifically when they are coming from far places, when they face these difficulties and problems, they may give up.
Yes.
They may start complaining. But it's good to look at the life of Sayyid Mujtaba Musa Billahi and the end of his life, that everybody is talking good about his lifestyle.
As you said, this sincerity of action and this effort, I mean, stopless efforts, has made him one of the greatest scholars of our contemporary Iran. Most of the foreign students are really interested in reading out his books, God and his attributes, you know, as we said, Western civilization through Muslim eyes, imamat and leadership, and also knowing God are among the most outstanding works of Sayyid Mujtaba Musavi Lari. Most of them have been translated by Hamid Algar, and one of them that is Knowing God by F.J. Golding. This is also a good translation, the English translation, out of his work. That's all right. We missed this outstanding man. At the age of 77, it was 1391, according to the solar calendar, one Saturday in the cold winter. According to his last will and testament, he was taken into Maktab al-Quran, which is very much close to the cemetery of the martyrs or Gulzar al-Shuhada in the small city of Lar, the place that he was born and he belonged to. And Ayatollah Shobairi Zanjani did the burial prayer on his body, and he was buried over there. May Allah bless him. He had a really fruitful life, and he was a source of blessing and source of benefit for all the people, truth seekers and justice seekers all across the world. Thank you much, Sheikh Ziaunia and Sheikh Mahtabi, for your presence in this program.
You are most welcome.
You are most welcome, and thank to the listeners also.
You're welcome. And dear listeners, thank you much again for listening to us. This was The Teacher, a program on the life and works of the most outstanding Muslim thinkers and scholars. For more information and to download for free our previous discussions, visit our website at parstoday.com/Ian Call of Islam page. Also, you can check out our YouTube channel and Instagram page, Call of Islam Radio. Till another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pastoday.com/en. And now,
you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.